When I reflect on my life, there are countless moments which I could identify to you and say that I was feeling lonely. I'm pretty sure you would too. And what's something that a lot of us do when we are feeling lonely? We push people away. It's interesting that this global self-sabotaging phenomenon unites us in action but separates us in consequence. Now don't get me wrong, we all need to learn how to be alone. But feeling overwhelmed by other people's presence does not always mean that there's something wrong with you or the other person. There's no point in pushing people away, and there's no point in going back to square one. There is a point in creating a relationship with yourself, and there most definitely is a point in seeking solitude. I'm Deb Shaw, and this is Take Two.
I never met someone from Roscommon until I was in Barcelona, because I always thought Roscommon was a make-believe place because I've never met anyone from there. But then I met someone in Barcelona.
Really?
Which destroyed my theory.
I've met two people from Roscommon, right?
Yeah, but the one I met had a Dublin accent, so I was like, you're a fraud.
Why? Because they been living in Dublin for a long
time?
Or
else he's just an actor who's paid to say he's from Roscommon.
Fact. The two people that I met from Roscommon did not shut up that they're from Roscommon.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of Cork energy.
It is Cork energy. The thing is, with Cork people, though, it's like, I've never been there enough, so like, I don't understand per se why they're so proud of it. But the characters that I've met so far are super.
Mm-hmm.
You, Connor O'Keefe.
Yeah, okay, Connor's great.
I brought James Power on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Solid.
That's solid. James Flynn.
Yes.
Cork has quite a bit of talent.
The Cork thing is just because we know it annoys other counties. It's just like a spite thing.
Is it?
But like, I don't really care about Cork.
We'll see about that. You know, if I brought Jason O'Gorman to design.
Jason's like a diehard. Like,
Jason is probably best LinkedIn game of all time. Just like,
yeah.
Cork everything.
Oh.
Cork
and
everything.
I asked him if he would do like different cities, and he's like, but why would I not Cork? Like, and I was like, yeah, but you could just do.
So is he actually like that in real life?
Oh yeah. Oh, like, just adores Cork. He's like, yeah, like, I'd go away for holidays, but he's like, I'd never live anywhere else. Like, he's like, Cork is the spot.
Can you like forget about like living in Cork all your life, but like in terms of opportunities, is Cork a good place to be at?
Yeah, it depends on what like industry you're in. Like, if you're in like tech or engineering or pharmaceuticals, like all the really evil
or
things. Yeah, it's like there's loads of jobs in those industries.
Okay.
But yeah.
Then other than that, not really.
Teaching, I guess. You can be a teacher anywhere.
Facts. So we're gonna chat a little bit about Lonely Boy. So you're the first repeat guest. How do you feel about that?
Pretty good about it. Yeah. We're going to call it Take Three, I presume.
Take Three. Yeah. Take Three with Dara.
Four. We're going to, I suppose, we double it. I don't know.
From upstairs at the pub.
Yeah. We had pints that day as well. That feels very, very wild. Just drinking pints, doing podcasts.
That's why it's
so good.
So now we're with water.
Yeah,
you know?
Which is my preference anyway.
No, in fairness, I'm bringing on this lad soon, and he doesn't even know it, but I'm just bringing a bunch of cans. Gonna drink over here. I don't care.
Class.
Like at this point, I don't care. I need pints.
Yeah, pints are.
Gas. But it is actually quite interesting to think, like, when did we meet each other? March, February, something like that, I think.
Yeah, if I was trying to think earlier, because in my head I was like, oh, it was probably the start of 2021, but it wasn't.
Q1. Yeah. No.
Yeah, but I thought it was that long ago, but I was like, a lot has just changed since the first time we met. So
I know.
Yeah.
So much has changed. And the thing is that you kind of teased Lonely Boy.
I did, yeah.
And I said,
it was coming out, but.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And I told you, why won't you release your nudes instead of being vulnerable? Like, as a real, like, professional.
As the cover,
person.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. In fairness, kudos, it's an amazing book, but like, this is so vulnerable. Actually,
yeah,
you
like,
could have put your
they're
nudes
like
in.
Mental nudes.
They're mental.
Essentially.
They are mental nudes, literally.
Yeah.
Well done, though. I actually love the fact that like, I read it before the general public.
Mm, very prestige.
Very prestige. Look at me. Look at that.
Look at that.
There you go. printed it myself at simpleprint.ie, by the way, not sponsored. So we're going to get deep into it. I'm glad that you're doing okay and all that kind of stuff. I'm assuming you're doing okay. How
yeah,
are you?
No, really good. Yeah, I think like writing the book helped me get to a better place. Because it was very like, it started, I think I mentioned this in the first podcast, it started as like just self-therapy. Like I was just journaling through stuff. And then I was reams and reams of pages. And I was like, this could actually be structured into essays that could like hopefully help people. And a lot of the feedback from like different authors who've read it first were like, this will help people. So I think Amanda Geard or Louise Nealon was like, this could save someone's life, which I was like, that's a insane, obviously, compliment to get. So, but to begin with, it did just very much help me to get through something I was struggling with for a long time, which is primarily the kind of my struggle with like maintaining relationships, which is a big theme in the book. It helped me to figure out what was going wrong and what I was doing wrong. So, and then once I worked through that, and obviously it goes up and down, but in general, I'm doing pretty good now, which is nice.
That's good. 1 month before the release.
1 month before, yeah. It mightn't be the same next month, but we'll see.
I know. It's going to be a little bit different. One question that I wanted to ask you before. I need to be careful though, because I don't want to spoil it for people. But a main factor about like you bringing up the concept of you struggling with relationships is you struggling to open up to women, yeah?
Yeah.
But what the one thing that I didn't understand that I wanted to ask you is, how come then you're so comfortable talking about like your mental health as a public figure?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then with women, it's difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's not so much that I'm unsure of opening up. It's that once I do open up to a partner or potential partner that they'll leave. And I think there was a lot of fear of abandonment, which probably stemmed from my childhood. And so like when I open up to the general public or whatever, there's no fear of people abandoning me because I'm just doing it to, you know,
take that space, content box.
You know, it's just okay. Like, so it's just very out and people aren't going to like come and go. Whereas like trying to open up with a partner, it's like, it's always that fear of, you know, I think it comes back to being cheated on. And, you know, also like Irby passing away, that fear of abandonment was ramped up even more so. So I think it's that was the problem. It's just that fear of being left on my own.
Because
I think, and I kind of worked through this in the book, and as we edited it, you know, the premise of the book was like, I've been lonely since Irby died. But what actually I realized was that I've just been kind of predisposed to being alone.
Yeah.
Like I'm just like being on my own. But for a long time, that aloneness manifested as loneliness, whereas it didn't have to be. It could have been solitude. And sometimes it has been solitude. But for a long time, every time I was on my own, it was loneliness.
Okay. Let's define what loneliness is and what solitude is.
So loneliness, the way I define it, is being alone without a choice. So when you don't want to be alone, that's kind of how I feel about loneliness. But it's also, I think there's a kind of another aspect where your loneliness comes from not being understood. So, you know, you can be surrounded, and I've always been surrounded by like really great people, and I've always had a support system, but maybe I didn't really feel like they understood me because I didn't really understand myself. Because like when I was 18, didn't know what I wanted to do in my life, didn't know what I was about. It was just kind of being what everyone else around me was, like just kind of mirroring them because I didn't know who I wanted to be. So that, when I realized I just didn't know, I didn't understand myself, that means no one else understood me, and that made me feel lonely.
Yeah.
And then solitude, I suppose, is when you're alone when you want to be. So I think in the start of the book, I kind of compare it to Superman when he's in the Fortress of Solitude. And it's like when you're, and I'm reading the book, I just read a book called Solitude by Michael Harris, and it's a brilliant read. I would recommend it. It's about like, you know, just reflecting. It allows you to become creative. It allows you to become more appreciative of the relationships you have, which is kind of counterintuitive because like you think being on your own would like disengage you with your relationships, but it allows you to reflect on your relationships. So like the example is if you're with someone you love all the time, you take them for granted because you see them like 24/7, you're surrounded by them, you're texting them, you're always connected. But when you're on your own in solitude, it allows you to reflect on how much you're grateful for that person. And that's the benefit of solitude, I think.
Mm.
So yeah, for I think they're the two definitions, but like I think the simple version of it is loneliness is being alone when you don't have a choice to be, and solitude is being alone when you're choosing to be alone.
Yeah. What's your relationship with yourself like now?
Pretty good, I think. Over the last 2 or 3 years, like since I started writing Lonely Boy, I really kind of figured out what I wanted to do, because for a while I was just kind of floundering. I was half into writing, half into basketball, didn't know what I wanted to be. And then at the start of this year, I just kind of took a leap of faith and said, I'm just going to go down the writing path. And like writing has always been a big passion, and it makes the most sense for me, but I never really thought it could be like a life path. It was just something you did on the side. Once I figured out that's who I was, then I kind of started to understand why I was probably resisting other parts of my life, because I was like, I'm only doing this because I have to. I'm only doing this job because I have to have this job. I'm only like, even towards the end of playing basketball, I was only doing it because I felt like I had to, because that's who I was, but I didn't love it anymore.
Okay.
So I was just like, this isn't right. And then I found what made sense and everything kind of just started clicking.
So like you leaned into the concept of being a writer per se.
Yeah, and like not even like being a writer, but like just being myself, and being myself is writing. It's expressing myself through words. That's not necessarily always writing. Sometimes it's speaking. Sometimes it's, you know, blogging, which is a kind of different to writing books. But yeah, it's just, I think finding a way to express yourself creatively.
Yeah.
And I think that's what everyone's creative in different ways, and writing's just my way of being creative.
It's your medium, per se.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's go back on the concept of relationships. So when did you finish writing this? Was it 2021?
Yeah, it would have been September of 2021.
What's your approach to relationships now? Like, has this helped you improve in that regard?
Yeah, but it's still like a work in progress, because it can't really be... I wish it could be fixed overnight, but it is very much like... So I used to love bomb and like rush into relationships and just be like, you know, enamored at the start, and then it would like fizzle out. So now I just take things way slower and just try to not get into like the physical side of things immediately, because I think in the past that would have been the, I suppose, default. And then when you go to that place too fast, for me, it kind of just the draw for whatever reason went away and it was just shit. So now I take things way slower, try to get to know the person before you're kind of intertwined with them in that way. And I think that is down to me figuring out stuff with Lonely Boy, which is really important. So yeah, things are going better, but there's still progress to be made, I think.
Yeah, because the last time I spoke to you, we actually mentioned this topic without even talking about Lonely Boy, which is you pushing people away, like kind of like a self-sabotage-y sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's cool to see, like, that's what I was most curious about after reading all of this is, has he, like, not did you just, like, up and leave and walk away from this book, right? But, like, did it help you? Have you improved since this?
Yeah, like, I think, so the urge is always still there to push people away, but it's really resisting that urge, because, like, the thing I want is beyond that urge, but in the past I've just caved to it immediately and be like, no, I don't want this. But like, if you just stick with it, you know, that's where you want to be.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like wisdom, like, because my brother's been in a relationship for like 10 years and he's engaged, and he was like, it's not always easy and it's not always like, you know, perfect. And I probably had this romanticized idea of that, like, everything is just going to like click. It'll make total sense immediately. And like,
he was
like, no, you do have to like resist that urge to kind of run away from the difficult emotions, which is definitely what I did for the better part of 10 years.
What would your take be? Because weirdly enough, I actually saw a TikTok. I don't know if it was today or yesterday, but it was like some lad at the gym, right? And it was something along the lines of, why did you leave your ex? You seemed so happy. And it's like, I had to focus on me first and all that kind of stuff. And I think right now, obviously there's a balance out if you're not in love, like it's a completely different situation. But I'm sure you have a lot to say about this in general when it comes to communicating said things about relationships or whatnot.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably a, there's a middle between like prioritizing yourself,
mm-hmm.
solitude,
yeah,
but then also like don't run away, like mm-hmm. especially because I think people are just like, not you think, you know, but people are imperfect,
yeah,
regardless.
I think for me, like, it is really important for me to have alone time. Mm. Like, I do need that time. And I think before, when I was getting into a relationship, I like subconsciously started to panic because I was like, if I get into a relationship, it means I'm not going to have any alone time, which isn't true.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what the instinct was. So I think, like, in that sense, you just need to like communicate your needs. And I never told like potential partners that like I need substantial time alone, obviously for work, because like writing is very solo endeavor, but also just to like be in my comfort zone, because that's where I'm comfortable, it's where I can just kind of like, you know, disengage for a while. And I never communicated that. So like when I was kind of like getting uncomfortable because I wasn't getting time alone, I probably projected that onto them, being like, this is your fault, but it's my fault because I didn't tell you I needed to be alone for a little while. You know, I need a few days where we're like, you know, because there's been times where I've like, you'd see someone like 4 days of the week and it's like three of those days or 3 days in a row at the very beginning of a relationship. And you're like, this, and I was like, this is just too much time together all at once. But like, I never told anyone. So that's obviously my fault, but I would have never clicked that at the time.
Yeah. Like, I can actually bring this up and we can figure it out together because I like you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Oh my God. That's just like the general thing. And what I found so interesting was that your teenage years, or what happened
mm-hmm.
per se, although you did mention that, like, not prone to loneliness. How did you word it perfectly? You kind of said that, like,
I have like a disposition for being
alone. You have a disposition for being alone. Yeah. But then you also mentioned about when you were 17, there was, before Irby died, mm-hmm. a girl cheated on you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that I never exactly thought of, because going in, how old am I? I'm 25. So 5 years, probably, not really. Are you an adult at 20? But like 4 years or three of being an independent adult. Yeah, you're
technically an adult.
Like, I'm technically an adult. But then like, if you were to put it in human years, I'm like 3 years old at being an adult. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what I was saying is that like the message that was always coming to me is like, it happened when you were young, you were a teenager, like that doesn't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, what happens to you as a teenager is actually like
mm-hmm.
carried on and has a massive, massive effect on you.
Yeah. And especially because like, not even that it happened as a teenager, but it was my first like real relationship with someone I really cared about.
Mm.
And then that happened and that kind of set the tone for the rest of my relationship. So I was afraid to open up and trust someone because I was afraid something like that would happen again.
Yeah.
So the easiest fix for that, even though it's not the healthiest, is like, well, if you never open up, no one can hurt you.
Yeah.
But what that does is that you start to hurt yourself because you're not opening up and you're not like sharing your life with someone. Because there's been times where like good things happen in my life and there's like no one to like celebrate that. Like on an intimate level, obviously you can celebrate with your friends and stuff, but like someone who like is really invested in you and you're invested in them, there's no one there
yeah.
for that. So at the end of the day, you're kind of celebrating on your own.
Mm.
And that's sad.
Without laughing at you.
Yeah, yeah. No, like, 100%, I empathize. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. But like, and that, but that was, that tone was set because of the first relationship.
Mm.
I didn't have to be like, I think if I went to therapy earlier or like, see, because two quite influential things.
So hard to not spoil the book, isn't it?
I know. Well, everyone knows a bit Irby at this point. So because two things happened like quite close together, when I went to therapy, I really did obviously focus on Irby's death and I never went to therapy to focus on my relationship with relationships.
Because you also think at the age of 17, it's like, oh, this is nothing. Like mm-hmm. it hurts.
Yeah.
But like, it's like, oh, they're going to make, an adult is going to make fun of me if I tell them that this is really painful.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But like, I've always been quite sensitive. Like, so I think maybe another person that wouldn't have affected that much, but for me, it just did. So yeah, it was just, and again, because I never really like went through it in therapy that first time around. So it wasn't until like the last 3 or 4 years where I started being like, because I had to deal with the depression which was caused by a different situation, I never like had a moment to like reflect on why relationships weren't working, because I would have assumed it was because of the depression, and then I came out of the depression and relationships still weren't working, and I was like, what is going on here? And that's kind of when I started doing the journaling, and figured out that there was kind of a more rooted issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Relationships, man, they're fucking tough.
They are tough. People, I mean, I guess like movies and stuff make it look really easy. So I was like, this will be fine.
Are you on dating apps?
Yeah. Not a fan. Like, it's just very much like, I feel like dating apps are just like there to make you feel good about yourself when you don't feel, when your self-esteem's low.
Yeah.
It's like, I can get a match. Someone likes me. That's great. But I, and to be fair, I've been on dates from dating apps and I've met some great people. So it's not like they don't work. I just,
yeah.
I always cringed like the idea of like telling people how you met, and you're like, we met on Hinge.
Tinder.
I mean, it is normalized now, obviously, but yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people really hate on dating apps right now, where it's like, no, I need to meet them the real way. And it's like, yeah, mate,
this is now the real
this
way.
This is now the real way. Yeah, like, yeah. If
especially,
you go up.
Especially if you're Irish, like, Irish people can't go up to strangers and start talking unless you're like drunk.
Always.
So like, the idea of like walking up to someone and being like, hi, is just terrifying. So
I'm Dara. Yeah, yeah.
So
what is your name?
Exactly. Like, so it's just I will get there. I mean, I think traveling alone helped me just get out of that comfort zone and being like, I'll just have to talk to random people because I'm on my own. So that
a pack of cigarettes and a lighter is the way to go.
Even just a lighter.
Actually, yeah. Just get some tobacco. When I was younger, I would genuinely, like, if I was starting a new job, I'd go to the talk shop or whatever around the corner shop, mm-hmm. cigarettes, lighter, and like first day it's like smoke break.
Life hacks with Debbie Shaw.
Life hacks, just talking shit all the time. Yeah,
yeah. Actually, to make friends. Well, you do talk a lot about like making friends as an adult, so.
I do. Maybe that's gonna be my thing. Maybe that will be my niche.
Yeah, you can write a book about it.
Making friends.
Yeah.
And what will the cover be?
In your 20s.
That with a cigarette and the lighter on top.
Perfect.
Facts. There's so much to go on about. So we're talking about death, mental health, and relationships.
Just all of it.
Do you still feel lonely? Like, do you still identify with that?
Do I still feel lonely? Sometimes, but not as often as I used to. In my early 20s, I did a lot of stuff to keep busy, to avoid being on my own, because then the thoughts would come, like negative, depressive thoughts. But now, my social battery runs out quite quick, so.
How old are you?
Turning 28 on November 24th.
That's why November 24th?
Well, it was just kind of serendipity. So it was meant to come out next week or November 9th. But it had to be pushed back because there was a different book coming out. So they were going to push it back a week. And then I was like, oh, if we push it back another week, it will be my birthday. And it has to be launched on a Thursday. So it just kind of happened there. And they were like, yeah, we'll just do it that week. So
shit.
It was nice. Pretty cool.
Will you be stressed or? No. Everything will be out.
The launch will be fine. Like, I don't mind that. I don't mind talking in front of people. It's just the stress will come in the week after if the book's like doing well or not, you know, but that's fine. That's
going to be hard to look at. Weirdly enough, you actually mentioned it in the book, which I really liked. A place of passion versus insecurity. That's what I have written down.
Mm-hmm.
But you also dove into the concept of jealousy. I'm pretty sure I highlighted it somewhere.
Yeah, the jealousy.
And when I read that, I was like, holy shit, that is literally me. Would you know which chapter it is?
I think it's called The Grip of Jealousy.
Grip of Jealousy or something.
Because also another thing we removed is the, you know, the way it says like chapter one, chapter two. I didn't want that. I just want them to be like
titles.
Yeah. Because it's not a like, chapters are for novels and it's not a novel. So, you know.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense.
I love this. I'm going to ask you so many more questions about book. But I'm going to read out your book to you just in case you haven't like read it, you know.
That's exciting.
During bouts of perceived underperformance, jealousy can be more toxic than anything. Jealousy also suggests that a person needs external validation to be happy. I know that during this time in my life, I was insecure about my writing ability, and so I was jealous of the attention given to other writers. My sense of value was externalized, which meant I wouldn't be content until I received proof from outside myself that I was succeeding. And so I was jealous of other people, not necessarily because I wanted their lives, but because I wanted the attention that they received for the work that they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of like pieces into what you literally just said there the week after mm-hmm. the launch. It's like,
yeah.
Is my book going to be performing?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's a kind of a complex thing, because I think 2019, 2020, when I was kind of figuring out who I was as a writer, and it still happens, I think social media plays a part in that. I'd see other people like who've earned the things they've gotten. It's not like they didn't deserve it. Getting deals, getting publishing contracts, winning awards, whatever it is. And I take that as like, because they're winning, it means I'm losing.
Yeah.
Which isn't true at all, because like, just because someone else is doing well doesn't mean it now means you're doing poorly. But I think I just wanted to be where they were in their career, and I wanted to jump forward to that part. And that was causing jealousy. And like, it's still crops up, but like, to mitigate that now, so if and it is kind of like just an exercise in like, again, resisting the urge to become jealous. If I see someone else doing well, and it's someone I know especially, instead of like being like, oh, they didn't, I should have got that, or I should have been shortlisted, I'll just like support them a lot. I'm like, yeah, well done, congrats, share it for them, all that stuff, because it kind of teaches myself to be like, you should be happy for other people. It's not mm-hmm. that you should be annoyed that other people are. Yeah. So, yeah. So it's learning that, because generally speaking, I am happy, especially like always very happy for people who do well in things I'm not involved in, you know, like different industries. So it's just hard to get. And like, that's a very common thing with writers. Like the people who've read the book already kind of resonated with that as well. But now it's like, yeah, it's not as severe, because I think I dealt with it and I kind of caught myself becoming jealous, and that was causing me to become bitter. And then I was like, this isn't where we want to be. This is just not a good place to be in. And you're putting yourself in that hole.
Like, it causes me like physical anxiety mm-hmm. sometimes. Yeah. Like for me, I'm just like on my stories, and then all of a sudden I see something and my heart
mm-hmm.
drops.
Yeah.
Like I'm tightened up, and I'm just like, I'm jealous, I'm angry, I'm frustrated.
Yeah.
At myself, because mm-hmm. why am I not there?
Yeah, and it can ruin your day. But I think the switch is like, because jealousy is just an emotion we feel. It's not like, it's not something you're choosing. It just happens. But you mm-hmm. can use jealousy to like I always talk about anxiety as a compass, but you can use jealousy as a compass as well. Because if you're jealous of something, it means it's something you want.
It means.
So it's like, okay, I need to put all my energy into doing this, and then maybe next year I'll be there.
Yeah.
So you can use it as fuel, but you can also use it as just to turn into bitterness, and then you're not doing any work and you're getting even more jealous. Just
feeling sorry for yourself.
Yeah, and you're going in the opposite direction, and then mm-hmm. it just kind of compounds.
Yeah. How did, like, if we were to talk about like maybe some practical tips, if someone is listening to this that is a creative, like independent artist, whatever, what has helped you turn that switch from jealous / bitter to productive? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you make jealousy productive in that regard?
A good thing I've done, and it has really helped personally and professionally, anyone I come across that I'm jealous of, I'll try and make a relationship with.
Yeah, that's what I've done. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I share it on my story.
You have someone in your network then that you know you aspire to be. Then the jealousy switches from jealousy to inspiration.
Ooh.
And that person will inspire you. You're like, oh, this is the path they took to get to the place I want to be. And now they're part of my network. So like you can change it to a support network very quickly if you just kind of switch your thinking, because the instinct is just to hate them, like very irrationally be like, I don't like this person now because they're doing something that I want. But if you switch and be like, that person is like can have value and does have value, obviously, because they're doing the thing you want. So like, I think, and it doesn't mean you like superficially make a connection with them. You kind of, if you think about it long enough, the reason you're jealous is because A, they're doing something you want to do, and B, you probably don't know them. Because I rarely get jealous of like authors I know, because I know them and we have a relationship. So it's just like, you're only jealous because like there's someone you've never, like completely outside the radar.
They're just a number to you nearly. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the most effective thing is to make a relationship with them, for sure. And then the other thing, as I said, like, if you just go against the instinct. So like, if you're jealous of something you see online from a person, rather than like internalize it and kind of lash out and be pissed off, support them. Just like give them support, because a lot of the time, especially online, the support you give out, you get back at some point down the line. It might not happen immediately, but like, you know, you get what you give out. So
yeah, like generally being a sound, I think that's how you ended it, but like being very sound.
Yeah.
Will take you far.
Because we're in an era of like where ego is becoming like approved. Like it's okay to be egotistical and self-centered and
what do you mean by that?
So like, I think, you know, a lot of Instagram and Twitter is very much like self-promotional, look at me, give me all the attention, which is like centering yourself as like the main character. Like main character syndrome is a very like cited thing at the moment.
So you're telling me you don't walk on a treadmill with an iced latte in your hand?
I don't.
And stress?
Well, not an iced latte. I don't think.
Okay. Americano.
So I think because we're in that era of like self-centered and narcissism, I think is oversighted. Like narcissism is a very like specific behavioral disorder. You can have symptom, like you can be narcissistic. It doesn't mean you have narcissism. It's like a very specific thing.
Yeah, it's a pure day.
But yeah, so I think because we're in that era, like I suppose the antidote to that is to do the opposite, like be selfless, support other people, and that is basically what being sound is. So
yeah,
that's why I tell people to try and be sound.
There is I have hope that one day social media will have a space.
Will be utopia on Earth.
Digitally, the metaverse, you know. Perfect. Where it's just like, no complaining.
That's a very high ambition.
No trauma dumping. No trauma claiming. I think you mentioned trauma here as well. I did that.
I did, just because like I think trauma's real, obviously. Like I have trauma, everyone has trauma, but I think not generally, but some people claim every like bad aspect of their life is a result of trauma. Like not everything is trauma.
No.
Some things are just shit. I think obviously dealing with the traumas in your life is very important to do, but like not everything in your life is as a result of trauma. And I think phrasing in that way is kind of puts you as a victim perpetually, because like obviously with trauma, it's not your fault that trauma happened to you. So if you see everything as a result of trauma, then there's no like responsibility.
Yeah. And I think that's where stoicism comes in. I love to drop stoicism into probably every conversation I have.
I saw a TikTok the other day where it was like a guy, like every guy who ever like picked up a book of stoicism, and he's like, this is gonna become my personality.
You ended it with Seneca, Marcus Aurelius.
I started the book with Seneca as well. Typical of that.
In fairness though, it's probably, you get it because it's the closest to scripture, kind of like the Bible or any like religious scripture, without it being religiously affiliated.
Yeah.
And also providing that ancient wisdom of like, listen, you can't control things. Listen, life is going to be shit. You're not entitled to anything. Yeah. You can only control your reactions, your emotions. And that's one thing that I've probably struggled with is, I think I kind of like am slowly getting better at controlling my own emotions, but I sometimes hold back in speaking my truth or being true to who I want to be in said moment out of fear of the other person's reactions.
Okay.
So as much as I believe that like you are in complete control of people's reactions, I'm kind of still scared, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know about you.
I think for me, if you have like a very like skin level understanding of stoicism, I think a lot of people think it means that if you're stoic, you don't show any emotion.
Yeah, lots of people think
that. Which is what you would take away if you read like one or two little tidbits. Yeah. But for me, it's more like understanding that you do have a lot of emotions and they're complex, but that they shouldn't control how you interact with the world. And that's kind of where the control aspect comes from. It's not that you shouldn't feel your emotions, which I think is what happened with like masculinity, that was kind of like conflated, and masculinity became this thing where you're not meant to like show emotions to the world, and that's what people thought stoicism was, and it's very different.
No.
But with the reaction thing, like, yeah, of course, like you can control your reactions, but you can't control someone else's. So like, I think that's probably what you're holding back. Maybe, I don't know. But like, for me, it would be like, I won't say this because they will react, even though it's what yeah. I believe or I think. And not even think, because like half the opinions I put online or in podcasts aren't like fully formed or like what I'm thinking about now and how I'm thinking about it. But that doesn't mean like this is what I believe 100%.
Percent. Like I am open to change.
Yeah. And I think like, I think I probably mentioned this last time, like that the idea of uncertainty, like the mm-hmm. one of my favorite quotes by Voltaire was like, doubt is uncomfortable, but certainty is ridiculous. So I'm always like, I'm not certain of anything that I believe or think. Like it's open to interpretation and change, and I'm probably wrong about 90% of it because I'm human.
Yeah.
So like, I think, but like, that's again like something that's very rare on the internet where people are like, no, this is what I believe, and anyone who doesn't believe this is wrong and fuck them and all this stuff.
It should be deplatformed.
Yes, of course. Of course. So yeah,
living at an amazing time.
Strange. Yeah.
Dara, what's the one thing that we are certain about in this life?
Is this like a,
do you know, quote your book?
From the book? Oh no, death probably. Yeah, yeah.
Talk about the fear of death.
Yes, my old friend. My old friend.
So when I read that bit about the fear of death, I was like, yep.
Mm-hmm.
That's me. I've probably, I think since turning 25, I have nonstop been talking about like, I can just be gone.
Yeah, the big mid-youth crisis.
I can
crisis.
Just be gone.
Yeah.
Quarter life crisis, mm. mind you, not mid.
Mid-youth.
Mid-youth. Ah, okay. yeah, it is a mid-youth. But probably, growing up, I have always been very scared of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I always weighed any option as like a massive, like, choice that will like steer my life into said direction.
Okay.
And I used to like not dramatize things, but I wouldn't be in the moment because I was always thinking about the future.
Right.
So that came with, so then add the fear of death, where if I'm not happy with where I'm at now,
mm-hmm.
I was always like, if I get hit by a bus, know that I am disappointed.
Yeah, yeah. Know that I didn't do what I wanted to do.
Like, completely. Okay. Because I always felt like I was in a waiting game, if that makes sense. It's like, I'm in college now, I have to wait until I'm out of here, and then I have to work. And then when I'm in said job, it's like, all right, I'm doing this, but I want to do that. So I need to like, get my skill set, improve a little bit, wait for the good opportunity, but create the opportunity. But that comes with hard work and time, you know, there's yeah. that serendipity and magic to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then I remember midway through lockdown one or lockdown two, where I was miserable at my first job straight out of college, I was on the phone with my parents going like, I want to quit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so unhappy. I want to quit. And they're like, no, Deb, times are uncertain. If you quit right now, like, do you want to come back to Malta? I'm like, no.
Yeah, right.
And I remember being really dramatic on the phone, being like, no, that if I get hit by a bus, no, that you have an unhappy daughter.
Oh, God.
But I was so scared of it, though. Yeah. I was so, and sometimes I still think that I might be, I don't know, like part of my fuel is not legacy. I have to like disconnect. I'm working on creating a healthy relationship with like the concept that I am not timeless, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. But I value death in such a way where like, listen, I know I'm not guaranteed tomorrow, so I really want to make sure that I'm doing my best today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about your fear of death?
Well, you said a lot of things there, so I'm going to go back and forth.
It's like a therapy session.
Well, I think like death is important because if there was no death, then nothing would have meaning. So yeah. If we were immortal, then everything would just be meaningless because you're just gonna, you know, if you lie to someone today in 1,000 years, you're not gonna feel guilty about it. Whatever, you know, if you do a terrible thing today in 1,000 years, you're not gonna feel guilty about it.
And people thrive on that.
Exactly. So, but, so death's important because it like, I think generally speaking, life is meaningless, but that doesn't mean life has to be without meaning. And I think death gives it meaning, because like, if you know you're not going to be here forever, the things you do now are important. Whereas if you were here forever, not so much. But I think the thing you're kind of, because I've never really thought about death in the, I need to look at the future and make decisions. It's never really affected me that way. So I think there's a study by psychologist named Zimbardo, and he did a study about time orientation, and he like mapped out, did surveys all over the world, and it kind of broke it down by country about the focus people put on different time orientations. So there's past orientation, present orientation, and future orientation. And a lot of like Western countries in the first world are future oriented, because we're always looking to like achieve the next goal, get the next thing. And that's probably like the one we're in. But countries like around the Mediterranean, so like Spain, Italy, have more present orientation. And that's why they're like, you know, the stereotype of Spain is like, no one's ever in a rush. No, they take their time because they're in the moment.
Yeah.
They're present. And I think it's finding a way to be more in that orientation, like be more present is obviously the goal. But getting a balance of like not being too much in the past, not being too much in the future, not only being in the present, because if you're only in the present, then you're not going to plan for the inevitable. Like, you need to save money. That's future orientation. But for me, like, death was more like the fear of it. It's more like just, I always had this idea of that, like, death was just the end, like nothing, you don't feel anything, you're just completely erased from the hard drive or whatever. And that used to like, and it still does, not to the same extent, but like just give me severe fear, like terror, just get this very, very like specific dread, and that would cause panic attacks. But the way around that, and it kind of comes back to stoicism as well, where like the way around is you need to think about death every day.
Yeah.
And at the start, I was like, that's an insane thing to recommend doing. But what I found is as you do that, you get the fear. It can be terrifying. But in the aftermath of it, you're grateful for like really benign things, like things you take for granted. So the fact that you have water, the fact that you can like move your hands. I remember after one panic attack, I was like, it's kind of crazy that I like I could move and stuff. And just, and then going out for runs was like way more experiential, because it was in the moment, and I was like, it's amazing, I can run in the countryside and the sun's setting and it's beautiful and I'm listening to music. So like the fear of death, although it can be very like primally terrifying, it does have a huge benefit that it makes you like far more like aware of the fact that you have so much to be grateful for. And gratitude then is important for like dealing with, you know, low moments or depression. If you can be grateful for more stuff, it gives you better perspective, and that allows you to get through the bad patches, I think.
Yeah. Yesterday I went on a run in the dark.
How was that?
Complete pitch black. It was actually, like you mentioned, gratitude for your body.
Mm-hmm.
Running in the dark is like, holy shit. Because you're just so, obviously, you're getting rid of one sense.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're really, I don't know what happened, but like, I really just felt like I was in my body in that moment in time.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're obviously not looking at other people because they can't see you, you can't see them.
Mm-hmm.
And it nearly felt like a meditation for probably the first time.
Mm-hmm. I always love running in the dark during winter because your face gets really cold and you can just really feel your senses, and it's just, okay. Oh, it's the best.
Uh-huh. Like, weirdly enough, I still haven't run in the rain. I know.
It's great.
I'm excited for
although
that.
I ran in the rain a few weeks ago and it was unbelievable. And then 2 days later, I was really sick. So I was like, it's good and bad. I think I just stayed in wet clothes like too long afterwards.
Yeah.
But if you get out of the clothes straight away, then running in the rain is pretty good.
Yeah, I kind of feel a bit too gross, kind of like sweat from wet and everything.
Yeah, you
like,
don't know what wet is, sweat or water.
Nothing. You know nothing. So yeah, that's interesting. However, this morning, I recently, literally on Tuesday, I bought the new Asics shoes, the Nova Blast, right?
Oh, nice.
First proper running shoes. I feel like it's a trampoline on my feet, right?
You can run for miles.
Sure.
potentially.
But I was slipping and sliding on all those pavements in Dublin City this morning. I was like, oh, nope. Gonna be a road runner soon. On the topic of gratitude, though, I want to read this bit because I think a lot of people will appreciate it. And if this doesn't make you want to buy the book, buy it. A gratitude for life emerges from the fear of death. And I think there's something worthwhile and important in that. It's a suffering worth enduring because we become grateful for things which are otherwise taken for granted. Things that are trivial fall away. Sorry, puberty. And we no longer care about being cut off in traffic or working long hours or any of that would-be grievances which can cause us distress. We shouldn't live completely castrated by the fear of death, although it can be difficult in the beginning to force yourself to think about the concept of death. You can use it to enrich our lives. Your lives, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. Our lives have meaning because of their impermanence. We can reach fulfillment exactly because we must eventually die. If life went on forever, then nothing we ever do would mean anything because we'd quite literally have all the time in the world. There'd be no endeavor worth taking because with unlimited time and enough motivation, we could accomplish everything. There's no meaning found in an infinite life. Meaning is to be found in the fact that our lives end. And so living knowledge of this end allows us to hold on to a sense of purpose. It allows us to live for something. Jesus Christ, man. Like, you're unreal. And I told you this when we first met, but like, I don't know. You're so talented. Like, I'm so glad that you discovered this medium. Honestly.
Well, I really appreciate that. That's really nice of you to say.
You're welcome. We have a great relationship there.
We really do. So wholesome.
So wholesome. But you've done an unreal job. And like, we can chat about so many more things, but like, I kind of want to leave it at that because you leave it unended as well. Mm-hmm. Unless there's so many, like, there's something else that you want to mention.
No, but like, I guess, like,
do you do gratitude lists?
No.
Yeah, me neither.
I do try to do this thing in the morning where, especially like, because my job is very much with the phone, so the work with a lust for life, and maybe we can talk about that. It's so much with the phone that like, I feel like I'm always on it. So in the morning I try to like leave my phone down, and as soon as I wake up, I just try to do like mental lists of things I'm grateful for. So like, and I might be like 3 or 4 things, but that kind of kickstarts. So you're not immediately into the stress and anxiety of social media and being on your phone. Like, you have a few moments in the morning where you're like, I'm grateful for this, I'm grateful for that. And that kind of gives you like, okay, now I can deal with all the bullshit. It kind of gives you that little shield at the start. But I think like it works differently for different people. So because I'm always writing, the idea of writing a gratitude list just feels more like work. So I'm just like, maybe I'll just think a gratitude list.
Yeah.
And that helps.
Makes sense, for sure. So what I don't know if I mentioned it on the podcast, but this book is super for young Irish people. Mm-hmm. Adults as well, because it is a little bit nostalgic, especially of their college years and being a teenager and all that.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that is your target audience, is like late teenagers.
Yeah, late teens, early 20s. But like, I wrote it, because I try to write complex things really simply. So like, I do write very vernacularly and like how I talk for the most part. And that's just to make it more, because I feel like I could have written this book in a far more like abstract and kind of academic way, and it just wouldn't really resonate as much. So I think that will help even for, you know, like, there's a lot of people, like my mother, for example, is, she hasn't read it, and I didn't leave her read it, and like all her friends and stuff want to read it. So it still will help. And especially like, I didn't even really think of this while I was writing it, but a lot of like parents of young men and parents of young women have been like, I can't wait to read this and give it to my son or give it to my daughter. And that's important as well, because like, if you do have a young person in your life that's going through something, the more you know about what they could be going through, the better. Mm-hmm. So the book will hopefully help parents as well, which is important.
Yeah. And what about younger adults and their mental health? Obviously, you work with A Lust for Life, which is a charity. They're targeting kids.
Yeah, we have different programs. So we have a schools program, which is for primary school kids, but we also do programs for like teenagers. And
perfect.
Our kind of age ranges from like young kids to like 25. Mm. It's kind of our bracket. So it's quite a broad spectrum, but we try to do a lot for, do as much as we can with the limited kind of resources we have for just young people in general. And that it happens in different ways. I mean, I guess a lot of our stuff is giving platform to young people to express their personal stories or lived experience. So I run I'm the editor for the website. So like every Monday I just get like emails and emails of people who want to write for us. And that's really, really like fills me with hope, because it's, these people are volunteering to be vulnerable, to help other people. And that's beautiful, you know, it's really nice. And then we do the more formatted stuff where we have a program that's been like developed by psychologists, and it's research based, that teaches children how to identify their emotions and how to express them in healthy ways, and how to, you know, build a toolkit to be like resilient in times of, they might have like mental difficulties where they're having bad days, or they might be dealing with stuff at home that, like, obviously we can't fix it all with like a toolkit, but it'll give mm-hmm. them a little bit of an advantage if something negative happens in their life. And it's really, the program, I think it's reached like 43,000 primary school kids, and that's, I think, a quarter of all schools. So we're trying to get into every school, and we're going that way for sure, but it's only been around for a year.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the program is amazing. And like, I didn't really have much to do, I didn't have anything to do with developing the program, because like I only started working with Lust for Life in May, but like the work that they've done is incredible.
Unreal. I was at the launch, and I kind of told you this, but it was so fascinating for me to see young kids going, how old were they, 10, 11,
yeah,
talking about anxiety.
Yeah, like, and some of the questions they had that day, I was like, I can't even think of these questions. They're like very like profound questions.
They were so profound and confident as well. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that so many of them were just like, yeah, I know the answer to this.
Yeah.
And it's like, these are the main feelings you have: happiness, sadness, fear. I was like, shit. I wish I knew that. I was just wafting away with my Ventolin going, I can't breathe. If we're talking about coping techniques and stuff. The last question I want to ask you, considering that this is such a vulnerable piece of work,
mm-hmm.
and you have done it in such a way, because you mentioned about taking things personally, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But you also have written an amazing piece where you're vulnerable, but you're also not blaming anyone for anything.
Yeah.
And how do you approach perceiving your experience by taking that responsibility of like certain things that happened to you that were completely out of your control, and of course affected you? Mm-hmm. Like, for example, you mentioned Irby's death. That's how it starts off with. You didn't know about Irby and like what he was going through and all that, although you felt that for a long period of time, you know that that wasn't it.
Mm-hmm.
How did you own your life and like the events that happened to you, still manage to be vulnerable while also not putting anyone under the bus for it?
Good question. I think I do always tell myself this, and I can't remember where I heard it first, but it's very funny and it's very true. It's not my fault, but it is my problem. Meaning that like, if things happen to me, which they do, they happen to everyone, it mightn't be my fault that it happened. And oftentimes with like traumatic events and X, Y, and Z, it's not your fault. But it is a problem you have to deal with, because if you don't deal with it, then things like emotional unavailability happen, relationships break down, because you're not dealing with something that happened to you that wasn't your fault. So that's what I mean by like, it's not my fault that this happened, but it is a problem that is now mine. And that's kind of how I look at it, because I mean, if I did just point the finger at several different people, I would have never dealt with the repercussions those things had on me. Like, the repercussions were going to happen anyway. So if I like externalize it and said, it's your fault, this is all down to you, all that would have done is like bring more negativity into my life, and it wouldn't have fixed anything. So I think it's just, I don't even think I ever like consciously made that decision, but it just made sense to me that like, okay, things happen, but like, bullshit happens to everyone. Like, shit happens. It's a bumper sticker. Like, so you just need to, there is a certain amount of personal responsibility that we all need to take about the horrible things that happen to each of us, even though it's rarely our fault. it is our responsibility to like try and work around it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I never feel like the need to be like, this is your fault or get nasty with people. Cause I'm like, okay, but like we all make mistakes. I've definitely done, and I've talked about it in the book, I've done bad things to people. I haven't always been good to people, and that's probably had repercussions in their lives. And you know, I have to deal with that as well. So it's not just dealing with the things that have happened to you, but it's also coming to terms with the fact that there are flaws in all of us, and there's bad things we all regret. And I think you have to deal with that too. Otherwise you're just going to become this ball of like stress, and you're not going to know why you're angry at the world, and you're not going to know why things aren't working out, because you're not looking inward. And I think, yeah, looking inward is hard. It's painful. Like a lot of writing this book it was a lot of pain and a lot of stuff I had to like come to terms with, and like who I was in my early 20s and how I was dealing with people, how I was dealing with relationships. And the reflection was just like, not a nice person, not someone I liked.
Mm-hmm.
And you still have to accept that, because that's part of you.
Yeah.
Like it's the monster is part of you. Like you do have to accept it. And I think once you do, it becomes less invasive, and it's no longer this big scary thing in the dark. It's just something you have to carry around in your pocket.
Yeah. You're unreal, Dara. Well done. I wish you the best of luck with this.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. Welcome. And thank you for joining me. And thank you everyone for listening. Bye.